Good morning, everybody. I am Suzanne Rushing, and I am an alcoholic. And I just want to thank the committee for this privilege for me to be a part of this conference. This is gratitude, y'all. When I first got to Alcoholics Anonymous, I would sit in the meetings and I would sit and cry because I was full of hopelessness, full of fear. But today, I have a life that I never thought I wanted. And now I just overflow with gratitude, and I sit here and I just can't believe that I have the life that I have today. And thank you, Tim. When you share that, it gets me every time, because this is why I do this, because this is not me to stand up here in front of all of these people, and I'm going to bare my soul to you today. But this is what I do in order to keep my sobriety today. And because of my sobriety, I have the life that I have today. And thank you all for being here. And thank you for the hospitality, you know, the gift bag. It's just been a wonderful weekend. I've enjoyed all of the speakers and getting to know new friends. And that's the cool thing about this journey, is that our paths cross and cross again, and we make new friends, and I just love it. I've never been a part of anything like this in my life, and I just wish this for everybody. So what I'm supposed to do today is share my experience, strength, and hope. And my sobriety date is July 9, 2004, and my home group is the 12 and 12 Club at the clubhouse on St. Simon's Island. We meet on Sundays at 6 o'clock, and we talk about a step every Sunday, and the last Sunday of the month we talk about a tradition. So if you're ever in the area, stop by and see us. So what it was like. I was born and raised in Bullock County, small town out in the country, to a family that we went to church every time the church doors were open, and I never saw alcohol. I know I'm alcoholic because I had the obsession early on in age. My goal and what I wanted to be when I grew up would be Nikki Newman. And she is the lady on soap opera called Young and the Restless. But I used to go over to my granny and granddaddy's. They live right next door to us, and I love my granny and granddaddy. And so I spent a lot of time with them, and every day at a certain time we'd watch Young and the Restless. And I saw this lady on here, and I remember the scene in my mind. She was walking across their den, and she had a long silver beaded gown, and she had a martini in her glass in her hand, and she was waiting on her Victor Newman to get home. And you know, and that's the kind of life that attracted me at a very young age, and I didn't even know what alcohol was. But when me and my girlfriend got together, we had played bar, and so we had a little. This is going to date me too, but you had the TV on this little roll around thing, and we take the TV off. And so that was the bar, and had the little glasses. I had the Coca-Cola and the Sprite, and pickle juice was the liquor. And so that's what I would play, and I had no idea what alcohol was, what it could do for me, but I was already obsessed with that look. You know, I wanted that, and it was a long time before I got that. My first drink, I was a sophomore in high school. My brother had joined the Air Force, and he was home on a visit, and it was homecoming at high school, and I had a hard time getting boyfriends. You know, I was always one of the guys, and I had two older brothers, so I was a tomboy, and I always wanted to go to homecoming because I wanted to wear the corsage. You know, I wanted to get the new outfit and all that. You know, everything when I was growing up is what it looked like. You know, we'd go to church every Sunday, and, you know, you had the new dress, and you had to look the part. And so that I grew up of what it looked like, and it didn't matter what was going on the inside, you know. So when my brother, we were going to homecoming, he got a bottle of Black Tower wine, and it was nasty. But I drank it anyway because it was my big brother. I loved him so much, and I wanted to be, you know, my big brother's, you know, sister. And I drank it, and I didn't get drunk, but I knew that there was something out there that I could, that would taste better than that. And so when I turned 16, my mom and daddy bought me a car, and I was allowed to go out one time a weekend. And from the very first time that I went out, I found alcohol. And I'm very shy, I don't think anybody likes me. You know, I have all the insecurities that people talk about, but I have a lot of friends. I have a lot of friends, but I don't feel like I fit in, but I'm there. But when I got the alcohol, and it was wine coolers, and me and my girlfriend, we split two, and I felt pretty. You know, I felt like I could talk to the boys, and I felt a part of, and I loved that. And so at age 16, I became a every weekend drinker, because back then it was really easy to find alcohol. It was really easy. I'm sure it is today too, but so every weekend on my, whether it's Friday or Saturday night out, I would find alcohol and I would drink, and never occurred to me that I should not drink and drive. It was, I'd drink, have fun, and then I had to be home at a curfew time and I had to be there or mom and daddy would get really mad. And it changed from, you know, wine coolers to liquor. And I have to tell this too, because I was so obsessed with alcohol. In high school, I passed a note, and I'm so naive also. I'm so naive. I just know that we say that we're going to the line to get liquor. So I'm passing this note to my friend. I said, I can't wait till Friday night to go to the line. And I spelled it L-I-O-N, you know, because that's what I heard, line. I didn't know that it was county line. But I knew that that's where we went to get alcohol. And so that's all I could think about. And my first arrest was in the 11th grade for underage drinking. And it was at the high school prom. So there I am in my pretty prom dress in jail. And I didn't have to call mom and dad this time, because we were on our way to a party and we didn't show up. So some friends said, well, they probably got arrested, so let's go check out the jail. And there we are. And so I'm late. I'm late for curfew. And so I get there and I'm like, what am I going to say to my mom that's going to make it okay? So I'm in my room and I'm sitting on the corner of the bed. And because of Sunday school and church, you know, that's what my mom, she's always preached to me. I said, Mom, please forgive me, for I have sinned. And she wrapped her arms around me and she said, honey, it's going to be okay. I always said there was no consequences to that because the charges were dropped, but I got suspended from school for 10 days. And I had to go to summer school that summer to take the classes so that I could graduate with my class. And so I did. And I graduated with my class. And still, I have no goals. You know, I'm still looking for Victor Newman. He's going to come whisk me up on his white horse, and we're going to live happily ever after. Well, there's no Victor Newman, because I drank till it ran out, blacked out, you know, from the get-go. I may not have been a blackout drinker right away, but I had no desire to stop, to control my drinking. It was never there. And it was very hard to find a decent guy, you know. So I was just always a part of the party. So I graduated and didn't know what I wanted to do. Mom and dad, well, mom, she wanted me to go to college, and so she signed me up for Georgia Southern. Now, I don't like school. I don't know how to study. You know, I have no interest in any of that. Plus, I don't know what I want to do because I'm still looking for Victor Newman. But I go to Georgia Southern, and I'm still living at home with Mom and Daddy because they're trying to keep me on that short leash. And and trying to get out of the house. Now, I've always worked since I was 16, but she knew my schedule, so I had to be home. So I started enrolling in night classes. I said, well, I'm going to go to night class so that way I can get out of the house. Well, I didn't go to class. You know, that was my excuse to get out of the house. I went and drank. And so it wasn't long. I didn't last very long in Georgia Southern because they were going to kick me out. And so I was like, how am I going to do this? I got to go to Mom and Dad and tell them, explain to them what their daughter is doing, you know, because my two older brothers didn't go to school. And so my mom's always wanted me to go to finishing school. And so I said, well, I'm going to go to her and make a deal. So I said, well, I'm wasting your money is what I'm doing. I'm wasting your money. I'll go to that finishing school you've always talked about. Well, she was so excited that I was going to finishing school that she just forgot that I was dropping out of college. But all that she's ever wanted for her daughter was to be a lady. And I don't know about y'all, but when I drink, I do not act like a lady. There's nothing about me that looks like a lady. And so I go to this finishing school, and of course I do not fit in with these girls because they're so serious about their hair and their makeup and what they wear, you know, and I'm like, I'm just going to make my mom happy. You know, I'm just trying to get her off my back, but I finish. And I still haven't met Victor Newman, so what am I going to do? So I'm just having jobs. I have jobs, and I do go to Swainsboro Tech, and I get a certificate, but I'm not going to do anything with that because I'm still looking for Victor Newman. He is going to come into my life, and he's going to take care of me, and I'm going to be able to drink and do what I want to do when I want to do it, you know, because that's all I've ever wanted to do. Just let me drink and do what I want to do. My next arrest, I'm 21 years old. Got a DUI, and back then it was like a $500 fine, and I didn't lose my driver's license. I had to fill out a questionnaire whether I went to short-term DUI school or long-term DUI school, and of course I lied on the questionnaire, so I ended up going to long-term DUI school, and I didn't learn anything there, you know. What I learned is I pick up the guys and we go out and drink after the class, you know. Nobody said anything to me that, you know, you may have a drinking problem. It was, don't get caught, you know. So that was my goal, is try not to get caught. Shortly after that, you know, I do find a guy. It's really hard for me to keep a boyfriend. But I did find a guy that he drank like me, and he didn't say anything about my drinking, which that is the key. They don't say anything about my drinking. And so at this time, I had moved out of Mom and Daddy's house, but I had moved into one of their rental properties because I am not going to use my money on rent. My money goes to drinking and partying, you know. So I'm living in one of their rental properties, and I'm dating this guy, and I see that he's drinking a lot. So I'm going to control his drinking. So there's nothing wrong with mine. You know, I could quit if I wanted to, but I don't want to, you know, because drinking was my solution for everything that was wrong on the inside. It fixed everything. And so I move him up into my house, or Mom and Daddy's house, and tried to control his drinking, which, you know, that didn't work. But Mom and Daddy found out that we were shacking up, and so they come to me and they said, you know, he's either got to go or y'all got to get married. So being the good alcoholic that I am, I get married. And you know, I did the big wedding, everything that my mom's there always wanted. You know, we did the bridal showers, you know, the whole 9 yards that she wanted for her little girl, and And it really didn't matter about him anymore because it was all about me and it was about the china and everything that I was picking out and the big parties, and I was having a good time. But when it come down to the wedding day, I was walking down the aisle and I was looking down there at him and I was like, I don't want to marry him. But I was thinking, well, I didn't know how to ask for help. I didn't have any clue of how I could say, you know, I may be making a mistake. My thinking is, well, it'll just be easier to get married and then I'll get a divorce. And so we got married, and you know, that it was over from day one. I mean, our wedding night was a big drunk, you know, all the friends come over, we get drunk, and that was my life. And so I call this the dark time of my life, because nobody offered me a solution. My solution was drink to oblivion, because I hated me and I hated my life. And I remember looking in the refrigerator one day, and because, you know, that's all I did. I drank every day until I couldn't feel anything. And I opened the refrigerator, and there was two boxes of wine on the top shelf. The crisper drawers were full of beer, and the corner cabinet was a half gallon of liquor. And at this time, I was participating with a lot of outside issues, a lot of things that I said I'd never do because I did not want to feel. And I was willing to do anything not to feel. But when I opened that refrigerator door, I was thinking, could I be an alcoholic? And I was like, no, I can't be an alcoholic. I have a job. I have a house, even though it's mom and daddy's house. I have a car, even though mom and daddy bought that car for me. You know, because I was thinking an alcoholic is somebody that lives on New York City streets and they warm themselves by the barrel and they drink out of a brown paper bag. Well, I didn't do that. So I couldn't be an alcoholic. But that was my life. I was every day completely numb. You know, I would do what I had to do that day, and then I would just get completely numb. Because I wanted to die. And that was my thing. You know, I couldn't go to my mom and dad or anybody and say, you know, you were right. I made a mistake. So rather than go and ask for help, I just decided I was going to kill myself. And then that way I can get out of my life. So I started thinking about how I was going to kill myself. When I was thinking, well, you know, I'm not the problem. He's the problem. If I just get rid of him, everything will be fine. So I had a .38 revolver at the time. And I pull it on him. I had it to his head, and I was going to blow him away. But I know at that time that there's a higher power working in my life, and I call him God. And I didn't pull the trigger. And shortly after that, we were divorced. And and I didn't want to live in that house anymore because that relationship, whatever it was mentally, physically, verbally abusive. And I was beaten down to nothing. And I just asked mom and daddy if I could move back home with them. And I'm 26 years old at the time. And of course, mom and dad said, yes, you can move back home. And so I moved jobs because the outside issues, I thought that was the problem, not my drinking. You know, drinking is fine if I can just quit the other. So what I wanted to do is I wanted to move jobs from Statesboro, and I went to Claxton because I wanted to get away from that, and then I would be okay. Well, at this point in my life, I went to work, and I come home, and I drank. Now, mom and daddy, they do not want you drinking in their house, you know, and I cussed mama out, and I said, you know, if you live my life, you would drink too. And so they tolerated it, but I was in one end of the house and they were in the other end of the house, so I didn't have to be right up under their face. And I wasn't at a completely numb stage at this time. You know, I was just I like to drink. I needed it. Oh, I didn't think I needed it, but I wanted it every day. And that's all I did. I isolated myself. I would just go to work, come home and drink, and go to church. You know, I was very active in church. I sang in the choir. I taught Sunday school. I did all that hungover, you know. Goodness. But it was all about what it looked like. I never missed a day of work because of my drinking, although I would show up at work hungover and I couldn't hardly do my work, you know. And anyway, I don't know how long that lasted before some of my friends convinced me to go out on my birthday, and I was like, no, I don't know how to do that. But we went out to a bar, and, you know, after a few drinks, I was like, this is what I've been missing, you know. So shortly after that, I moved my job from Claxton back to Statesboro, and at this time, I don't know how old I am, 28, 29, 30, something like that. But my friends are like 21, 22, 23, you know, because people my age had started getting married and having children and settling down. And I was still partying, you know. I was living life. You know, people that got married and had kids, I was like, yeah, they just don't know what they're missing. You know, I was all into the party world. That's all I wanted to do. So I'm going to go ahead and skip to my sobriety date of what happened. July 9, 2004, I had started dating Robin. He's my husband. He's here with me today. Thank you. And it's a Friday, and where I worked, everybody drank, and we loved to go to happy hour. And so at 5:03, I walk into our bar that we go to all the time, and I used to pride myself on this. I'd walk into the bar, and they knew exactly what I wanted. They would have me two double vodkas with a splash of soda water, a twist of lime, and I can remember sucking those down and being able to breathe. Now, my intentions after that would probably be to switch to beer or something like that, because I was always trying to control my blackouts. My friends were always trying to control my passouts. You know, because I'm one of those drinkers. There's a picture of me. We went to one of these Japanese restaurants in Savannah. I drink full steam ahead, you know. I drink it like it's water. I don't even care. You know, I'm just drinking because I love to drink. And we're at this Japanese restaurant, and I'm passed out on the little thing where you sit, you know, because I just drink until I can't drink no more. And I don't care where I'm at. I just fall out. And then my friends have to pick me up and get me where I need to go. So they are always trying to control the passouts. I'm trying to control the blackouts, because there's so many times that I wake up in the morning and I don't remember where I've been, what I've done, or anything. You know, I would just get home, and I used to take advantage of this because I was raised in church. You know, I was like, well, God's going to take care of me. You know, because the next day I was always home safe. And so it never occurred to me that that's probably not a good idea, you know, to drink and drive in a blackout. So what happened on July 9, 2004, I'm at this bar and with all my friends, and I probably told them to try to get me out of there at the end of happy hour. They probably tried, I don't know. But my next memory after that is being at my boyfriend's house, and where he lives, there's nothing but windows around. And I wake up to see a cop all the way around the front of the house. My next memory is having handcuffs slapped on my wrist. And my next memory is being in this room and people yelling at me. And I felt like they were right here in my face. And they were wanting to know what had happened that night. I didn't know. So they put me back into the holding cell, and I remember sitting on that cold cement bench and really trying to remember what had happened that night. And there was nothing but darkness. I could not remember anything. So I don't know how much longer it was before they pulled me back out and they wanted to know if I had remembered. And I said, no, I cannot remember. I said, can you please tell me why I'm here? And they said, "You really don't remember what happened last night?" And I was like, "No." And they said, "Well, a 13-year-old girl was killed last night, and another man may not make it." At that moment, I wanted to die because my life was over. How could I live knowing that my actions and my behaviors had taken someone's life? Now, they found out that I was not the driver. It was my boyfriend, but it could have been me. How many times have I drank and drove in a blackout, not knowing what I was doing? I would say just about every day. So anyway, they said that they were going to call my mom and dad and they were going to come get me. And I was like, "No, they're not going to come get me." You know, when I got that DUI, that mom and dad come and get me, and in the middle of the jailhouse, mama goes, "That is not my daughter." You know, and this was a whole lot worse than that. But they did come and get me, and I didn't know what to do. All I knew what to do was to cry and to pray. And I had a friend that had gotten sober a year before all this happened, and she called me and she said, "You need to go to AA. It'll teach you how to live life." You know, and I used to party with her, and she was a whole lot worse than I was, you know. And AA is good and all for her, but, you know, it's just a bad circumstance, you know. And, you know, we were trying to get my boyfriend bonded out, and the judge, court ordered him to treatment, and he went to the same place. And so they go to these outside AA meetings. So his dad said, "You know, if you want to see him, you can go and go to these AA meetings on Tuesday and Saturday nights. You won't be able to talk to him, but you can see him." And I was like, "Well, okay." So I called my friend back, you know, and I said, "How do you join this AA?" And she was already aggravated with me because I didn't listen to her. And she said, "Well, if you're serious about it, call this other girl." The difference is when I called this other girl, she told me her story. And I sat and I listened to her story. And when she got done, she said, "If you can relate to anything I just said, then you may have a problem." Well, I just busted out crying because I could relate to everything she had just said. And I could just see alcoholic being stamped on my head. And then at the same time, I was like, "Oh my gosh, how am I going to do this? You know, I got my drinking friends here. I got my drinking, drugging friends. I got my church friends here. How am I going to put this AA into my life?" You know, it was just so overwhelming. But at the same time, there was this peace that came over me and it said, "Just do it, Suzanne." And so I did. My very first AA meeting was a women's meeting. And there was about 12 women there, and I'd never seen them before. But when they opened their mouths and started sharing, I was like, "Where have you been my whole life?" Because what they were saying was things that I had thought up here in my head. But I would never tell anybody what was really going on inside of me because I was already known as Crazy Suzanne. If they knew exactly what was going on up there, they would have me locked up somewhere. But that was the attraction that kept me coming back. And I was terrified at this time in my life. You know, I can't even describe to you the fear and the hopelessness, everything, the lawyers, the investigators that was going on. And I was so full of fear that whatever they told me to do, I was going to do it because I felt like I was being followed. So they told me I needed to get a sponsor. Well, I shopped around for that sponsor, you know, because I really wasn't serious about this. You know, I wanted to find somebody that wasn't going to make me go to meetings, that wasn't going to make me do those 12 steps up there. And, you know, I just wanted to look good. You know, I wanted to look the part, play the part, but I don't have any interest in none of this. And so I was shopping around for all of that, and one night the lady that I had called, she told her story, and After the meeting, I did the right thing. I went up to her and I thanked her. And she wanted to know if I had a sponsor. And I was like, no, not yet. And she says, well, you need a sponsor. She said, at least a temporary sponsor. And, you know, out my mouth goes, would you be my sponsor? But my brain was going, no, what are you doing? Because I had heard that she was going to make me write a life history, and she was going to make me work those 12 steps, and she was going to make me go to a meeting every day, and she was going to make me be part of service. And, you know, I had no interest in any of that. You know, but I am so grateful today for her. Because, you know, my boyfriend got bonded out. We had the same sobriety date. The day that we picked up our 90-day chip, he asked me to marry him. A month later, we got married. And 4 months later, he went to prison. But see, I didn't see any of that, you know, because I live in this delusional world. And I'm thinking, you know, we're not drinking and drugging anymore, and we're trying to do the next right thing. There's no way that our God will send him to prison. But she saw reality, and I am so grateful for her because she started me on the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. So February 28th, 2005, I was turning Robin into jail, and I was okay because I had started on my journey, and I knew that God was going to take care of us if we continued doing the next right thing. And that we had a purpose and a plan. And the thing is, you know, the preacher that married us, he was brand new in our church. I mean, he brand spanking new. And we wanted him to marry us. And we went to him and we told him our story. You know, we wanted to fill him in what was going on. And when we got done, he was like, wow. He said, God has a plan for y'all. Well, I start crying because the little girl, her name is Charlotte. I said, what was her plan? He said, maybe her plan was to save you two. And I can tell you, when I was first getting sober, going to these meetings every day, and trying to do the next right thing was hard. You know, getting sober for me was the hardest thing I've ever done in my life. And there'd be so many times that I would leave work at 5 o'clock and I would go, great day. I didn't make anybody mad. Nobody made me mad. I think I'm just going to go home and play in my flower bed. I love to play in flowers. And I'm not going to go to that meeting. But then I played the rest of my day off, and I was going to have to call my sponsor, and she's going to ask what meeting I went to. Well, I can't lie, because they say if you lie, you're going to get drunk. Well, I don't want to get drunk, and it's not because I don't like to drink, but, you know, the circumstances, it's probably not a good idea. And so I go to that 5:30 meeting, and it was crazy. I would get there, and I'd feel so much better. But I know my brain was out to kill me. You know, it was trying to talk me out of doing what I needed to do in order to help me. And then there would be so many times that, you know, I got sick and tired of doing the next right thing and nothing happened in my way. And I'm like, screw this. I am just sick and tired of this. And the old timer would say, don't leave before the miracle happens. And I was like, well, what if my miracle's tomorrow? You know, and what my miracle, I wanted my miracle to be that my husband would not have to do all that time in prison. So I was going to come back, you know, because that's the miracle that I wanted. And there would be times that I would just say, screw it, I'm not going to do this anymore. And then Charlotte would come into my brain. And I didn't want to screw up her purpose and her purpose for her life, was if it was to save me and Robin, I didn't want to destroy that. And so she kept me sober long enough for my miracle to happen. And my miracle was one morning, I was like 2.5 years sober, and I'm on the edge of my bed on my knees, and I'm thanking God for everything. And I said, "Thank you, God, for taking care of me." And as soon as it come out of my mouth, I was like, "Oh my gosh, I have finally found the something that I have been looking for my whole life to take care of me." It wasn't a man. It wasn't Victor Newman. It was a God of my understanding. And that's when I really fell in love with Alcoholics Anonymous, because I believed that if I kept doing what was right in front of me, that everything was going to be okay, because it had been, you know. And I didn't do any of it gracefully, trust me. I did it kicking and screaming the whole way, but I did it, you know. And through the experiences that I've been through, it's gotten easier. I don't kick as much. And because I know that, you know, my faith is being built every time I go through an experience like that, that I'm going to be okay. But I still don't accept it right away. You know, I have the tools that this program has given me, and that's to call my sponsor, run it by her, go to a meeting, and give it to my fellows, and, you know, get the feedback that I need to. And I feel like God works in these rooms. You know, this is where I get my answers. You know, and if I don't let you know what's going on with me, how do I get my answers? You know, and I just have to put it out there and then keep going. And then some days, all I can do is just go to work, go to a meeting, and help a fellow alcoholic. You know, and today I just love my life. And what it's like today is, you know, I don't know what time it is. Do I have plenty of time? I just want to tell this quick little journey, because God has just really taken care of me since I've allowed Him to. How about that? I was always worked with insurance, and you know, I do my prayer and meditations every day, and I felt led to leave this job, and that's when I started working. I was 14 months sober when I started working in treatment. And I loved it, you know, because I can be me all day long. You know, I can talk this program and help fellow alcoholics all day long, and I loved it. And, you know, when I worked at the hospital during the day, and I needed a house mom at night, and I became a house mom for a women's extended treatment program. And so I was just surrounded by recovery. You know, I didn't have the gift of treatment or extended treatment, which I see a lot of people that have that opportunity, and I was always so jealous, so envious that they could go and just focus on them. And because what happened to me is my husband went to prison and I inherited all the responsibilities, you know, and I've never done that before in my life. And here I was 35 years old and I was responsible for making the house payment, you know, the insurance, you know, all that stuff that I've never worried about, you know, because I would do my best, but if I couldn't follow through, my daddy was always there to pick up the pieces, you know. And so for the first time in my life, I was being responsible. And it was hard being responsible and focusing on my recovery. But God had a plan, and He just put me in the center of recovery, and I was just taken care of. And my job, they sent me to these conferences where I started getting to meet these wonderful people in my life, and that's really when I fell in love with this fellowship, because you just meet people everywhere you go, and I just feel at home. You know, whenever I'm in an AA meeting, anywhere, where I'm home, and I love that feeling. So, anyway, 2.5 years into it, you know, I can't wait for my husband to get out of prison, because I want him to come home and take care of things. You know, I'm tired of being responsible. And the doctors where I work at, you know, everybody, I let everybody know what was going on with me. You know, I have no secrets today. You know, I just lay it out there. And I'm always willing to get feedback, you know. And I did this to a friend, He said, "Do you want me to be honest with you, Suzanne?" I was like, "Yes," but my brain was like, not really, but... But he said, you know, I was really going to him to try to get my husband out of prison early. And so he was like, "You know, you're full of crap. What he needs is when he gets out of prison, he needs to go to a halfway house to learn how to live recovery. You know, maybe he hadn't drank and drugged in prison, but he does not know how to live this program." And he goes, "I do not want to see him bring you down." You know, and I'm grateful for that I am surrounded by people that love and care about me. You know, that they could see that. When all I wanted was for him to be home, and I missed having a man around. You know, I just missed the touch and everything. It was just really hard to go that long without him. But you know, those seeds are planted, and all God just provides the way. You know, and all I have to do is put one foot in front of the other, and the doors open and the doors close. And it's just been an amazing journey since I've gotten sober. And, you know, I picked Robin out January 10th, 2010, and there was already a halfway house in Brunswick that were willing to work with him. And I took 2 weeks off, and we were able to be together for 2 weeks, and I took him down to Brunswick and dropped him off, and just don't know what's going to happen, you know. I'm always seeking God. You know, my sponsor said it's in the seeking that you find. And, you know, there's been times when I'm working with sponsees, I pull out my journal when I'm going through a lot of fear and I don't know what God's going to place before me and how's he going to work these things out. And I write down the God things that are happening that day, because when I'm full of fear and I don't know what's going to happen next, I need to see God today. And it may be just in a tree, you know, but I need to be seeking him on a daily basis to give me hope that I'm going to be okay. And it's really cool to pull those journal entries out and see how God was working in my life. And he wasn't happy about going down there at all. Good thing we couldn't talk for 90 days. Because, you know, by then he said it was 6 months before he realized why I had sent him down there. And it was a year program. And at a year, you know, God still hadn't told us, you know, where are we going to be? Are we going to be in Statesboro or Brunswick? I don't know. God hadn't said, because I have learned today, I do not move, I do not make a decision until it is very clear. And I mean, it's not just one time, but it's several times that's been told to me. And it's, my sponsor said, "It will be clear, clear as a bell, Suzanne. Do not move until you see that." And I've learned that. And by doing that, life has just been wonderful. So at a year, nothing had happened, and what had happened is they asked him to be house manager, which signed him up for an additional 6 months commitment. And at that time, he said he would be honored to be the house manager. And, you know, and that's how God works. You know, that's how this program works, is you stick around long enough, you don't like it in the beginning, but if you give it a chance, you'll learn to love it. And so at this time, you know, we still don't know at the end of the 6 months, are we going to be in Brunswick, Statesboro? And so we start doing the footwork. That's what I've been told to do. Do the footwork. God will provide the way, or he'll stop the way. And so I was trying to get him in Statesboro because I love my job. I did not want to leave my job. And, you know, I was tired of making all the changes. It was time for him to make the changes, you know. And so we're doing all the footwork in Statesboro, and I get him several interviews for jobs. He gets several interviews for jobs, and they're all no. And there was this one job that was supposed to be a guarantee because it was a friend. And I was like, well, that's a guarantee. That's, you know. But it was a no. So I was like, well, you know, of course I'm talking to my sponsor every day and talking to my home group. And I go to my supervisor at work, and I was like, you know, we've been doing the footwork here in Statesboro. We're going to change our footwork to Brunswick. And when we did, the doors just started to open. It just started happening so easily. And it was like we had a house in Bullitt County, and we made one phone call, and the guy agreed to buy the house at what we wanted. And, you know, and the economy at the time was bottom out. You know, nobody was buying anything. You know, everybody was selling. And we took that was God's answer, you know, to go on to Brunswick. And that was just, it was just so cool to be a part of that, because in July I had turned in my resignation, and they had asked me to stay till end of July, and we still hadn't found a house because we were going to stay exactly where we were until we were together, because we didn't have any money. You know, all our money had to go to the next house. It wasn't, we were going to pay rent somewhere. And so we still hadn't found a house. So at the end of my my last day at work, we didn't have anything. So I went to the CEO, and I was like, I don't do downtime very well. You know, can you use me anywhere? And do you know, I never missed a day of work at that place. My last day of work was November 23rd. That was the day before Thanksgiving. And we closed on our house in Brunswick that Monday, November 28th, 2011. And that's, I already knew that was home, because a friend of mine had already asked me to speak November 29th in Brunswick. And it was so cool, because when I was leaving Robin at the house, we were painting and everything, and I was going to speak at this meeting, and I was driving across the causeway, and I was like, I felt like I was at home. You know, there was no fear in leaving Bullitt County and going to Brunswick. I felt like I was home. And that, you know, when you're doing God's will, that's the way it should feel. It should just feel right. And that's why I don't make a move until I know that it's clear as a bell. Because when I have, everything has just flowed wonderfully. And I can't think of another way to live my life. What it's like today, me and my husband, we wake up every morning. We get on our knees together. I open up with the third step prayer. And he says a little something, and he closes with the seventh step prayer. And then we jump back in bed and we do our readings together. I can't think of a better way to start the day. You know, and our relationship is so good. You know, I've never had anything like that, to where I can just be me, and for him to love me, even on my crazy days, because I'm still crazy. And he's so laid back. He just lets me get crazy, and then he wraps his arms around me and he says, I love you. And I'm so grateful for that, because I've never experienced anything like that before in my life, and I love it. And it's all because of Alcoholics Anonymous that gave me a new way of living. And I wouldn't trade that for anything. I work in a treatment center again. I can't think of anything I would rather do than work with alcoholics and drug addicts. I just love it. Trying to plant that seed. That's what I'm trying to do today. I have a lot of sponsees, and I love it. They help me so much. You know, I just don't understand why they asked me to be their sponsor. Like, I'm crazy. And but they help me so much. They just keep me grounded, and they keep me in the program, and that's what I need, because I have a responsibility today for this program. I need to walk the walk, you know. And so when I'm making a suggestion, I need to be doing that. So it keeps me in this fellowship, keeps me in the program, it keeps me in the book. And I need that. And I just love my life today. Thank you for the opportunity of being here, and I hope everybody has safe travels home. God bless you.